Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CultTrollMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. It's the 1960s in Kingston, Jamaica. Randy's is a legendary music store, a place where fans of music and the musicians themselves can listen to the latest hits. And upstairs on the second floor, there's a studio, a place where new tunes are being recorded and the music, ska, reggae, and dub, is being released worldwide. All the greats, people like Sly and Robbie, Dennis Brown, Peter Tosh, Jimmy Cliff, Lee Scratch Perry, Bob Marley, and the Wailers, all spend time there, with some songs climbing to the top of the charts. The studio is run by husband and wife team Vince and Pat Chin. But when the mood in Kingston changes from peace and calm to violence and gun wars, the studio is forced to close down. The Chins move to New York, and the building itself is battered by storms and robbed by looters. But what happened to all of those recordings? Studio 17, The Lost Reggae Tapes, is a new documentary that looks at that recording studio, the people who made it work, and the music itself. Boxes and boxes of rare, reel-to-reel tapes that somehow have survived until now, when they're being faithfully restored, archived, and some re-released. The film includes interviews with many musicians and the Chins themselves, illustrated with hundreds of period photos and video clips, along with non-stop music taken from those legendary recordings. This feature documentary is the work of award-winning director and cinematographer Mark James, a student of fine arts at London Goldsmith College and film production at the Royal College of Art. He has made docs about Damien Hirst and Brian Ferry, as well as horror films like Vampire Diary. Studio 17, The Lost Reggae Tapes, is having a special Toronto screening on August 15th at the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Cinema at 7 o'clock p.m. with a Q&A to follow as part of a cross-country tour. And I'm very pleased to have Mark James on the line from Montreal to tell us more about those Lost Reggae Tapes. Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi. So, you're from London. How did you find out about a long-lost studio in Kingston, Jamaica?
Well, it's a long story, actually, but I'd been in Jamaica making another documentary, a slightly strange documentary, and I came back to London and bumped into reggae journalist Reshma B, who had actually discovered about these tapes and had spent time with Clive Chin and written a story about the restoration of the tapes and the whole history of the tapes. And she'd also done a radio program in London about it. She told me about the story, and I was just blown away by the whole background. It was a very rich story. It was a story about music. It was a story about a family. It was a story about history, and all these things sort of intertwined together. And, as a filmmaker, you're always looking for a strong narrative and strong characters. And ideally, if it's got music as well, you've sort of got everything in one package. So for me, it was the sort of perfect subject. We really took it from there. We started with a very simple, I managed to get to New York, and we managed to do some interviews with Clive while he was still transferring some of the tapes and working on them. And it really just built from that starting point over several years. It has to be said, it's taken several years to actually make this film. That's how it all began.
And Clive is the son of Vincent Pat, right?
That's correct. Well, he's actually Vincent's son, yes.
Correct. Yeah. And when did these tapes first come to light? When were they first rediscovered?
Well, I think the thing is, they had been abandoned, as you said in your very good introduction, very thorough introduction, that they'd been abandoned in the late 70s, I believe. I'm trying to remember the exact dates. Because of the political turmoil in Jamaica at the time, a lot of people were left Jamaica, and they then were abandoned, and there were various events. There was storms, there was a hurricane, and there was looting, and it was really left in a terrible state. In the film, you can see photographs of the state that it was in. And I don't think anybody thought they had much value, to be honest, because then, as you said, Pat Chin and Vincent Chin went off and set up VP Records, which VP standing for Vincent and Pat, and there started a whole new genre of music and a whole new audience and so on. So I think it was only later when... Tragically, Clive's son was murdered later, which is in the film. He wanted to do something about the tapes, and he went back to Jamaica and managed to retrieve them all. And that was in, I think, initially in the late 80s, but it took him a long time to get around to actually doing anything with them.
So can you talk about Studio 17, or Randy Studio, some people called it? What's so special about that place?
Well, I think the thing is, unlike some, because there are other famous studios, of course, in Kingston, Jamaica, you know, Studio One, and, you know, there are lots of other famous studios. But the thing about Randy's Studio 17 is it was, as you said, it was a store and a studio. I mean, the studio was sort of added later. It started off as a store, and then they added the studio later. So it became a kind of hub. So it wasn't just, you know, a studio or just a store. It was sort of everything. You could go and record your record. You could go downstairs and buy a record. You could sell your records there. And interestingly, it was a place where all the musicians hung out. There was a famous spot just near the near Randy's Studio 17 called Idler's Rest, where all these, you know, quite well-known musicians would all hang out and hope that Vincent Chin or later Clive Chin might come down and need a guitarist or a drummer or, you know, a trombone player. And they'd just be hanging out there, and they'd sort of go up and, because in those days they just would record records quite quickly. You know, it would all be done live. It wouldn't be multi-tracks. You know, these records were recorded on just one or two tracks. So they'd record all the backing, all the music on one track, and then the vocalist would come in and record their vocals on the other track, and that was it. It was very simple and quite fast turnover in those days. And the other thing that was important about it is that it wasn't an exclusive studio in the sense that only their artists could record there. Anybody essentially could hire the studio or record there, and a lot of people recorded there, like Lee Scratch Perry recorded the early Bob Marley and the Wailers albums there, and Peter Tosh recorded an album there. Lots of people used the studio, and they liked the facilities and the sound and the whole vibe of the place, and it wasn't just an exclusive, you know, to particular artists.
So your film traces the evolution of musical styles, including the shift from ska to reggae. What part did this studio play in this transformation?
I'm glad you asked that. I'm not exactly sure how it. I guess it was just the way the music developed. You know, it was it started off initially as a sort of mento style, was the sort of traditional music of the island. It was the kind of music that you see in old documentaries. You see bands playing at the port with American tourists and things arriving. Ska was very much a sound of the island, which really evolved after Jamaican independence in 1961. I think just the rhythm of it, there's quite interesting, you know, the speed of it. Ska was very fast moving and was great to kind of dance to, but I think, you know, it's a hot country and they wanted something a bit slower, so it sort of slowed down to what they call rock steady, and then that later evolved into what we now know as reggae. So I think it was just a kind of an evolution of different and all sorts of different musicians and artists make claim to discovering different aspects of this, but overall that's how it evolved.
Well, one aspect does seem to be Well, I mean, we can't prove that it started there, but Vince Chin's production seemed to introduce the concept of dub. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. Well, they upgraded the studio at a certain point from being essentially two tracks, which is what most of the early recordings were, to I think it was four or eight. I can't remember the exact number of tracks, but they bought in a whole new system. Because in those days, today we're so used to being able to do like 200 tracks on our laptops or even on our phone. But you have to remember, in those days, they had to have huge amounts of very expensive equipment just to do quite basic recording, which would have been very expensive. And I mean, you see it in the film, these wonderful old machines with dials and meters that go up and down and great big knobs and huge tape recording machines just to really record just a few tracks, so when they got the four track machines in, you could about what they call bounce. You could bounce sounds and music from one track to another track, so you could overlay and overdub, and that was really the starting point of dub reggae. Because of the technical development, it meant that you could introduce all kinds of sounds and do all sorts of things other than just record the music and the vocals. So that's really how it started. And the famous Java Java dub track, recorded by Pablo, what's his name? I forgot his name now. Augustus Pablo, the Java Java dub track. That's featured in the film, and Clive, thinks that was perhaps the first dub reggae track recorded. But it was really just sort of experimenting and using the tools of the tools, seeing the studio as an instrument in itself, not just a place to record music. That was the key point
And
of it.
it's an unusual track of music. The musician plays, is it a harmonium? There's a little machine where
Yeah,
you
what's it
blow into one
called?
end and it has a keyboard.
It's called a melodica, I believe.
Melodica,
Yeah,
yeah.
it's a funny machine. Yeah, you sort of blow into it and create this quite strange sound. But it's very hypnotic, that that tune, da 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 da. That Java 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 track is very. It's got a real sort of hypnotic sound to it, and it's just a sound. It's not. There are some vocals in it, but they're not really. It's not really a song. They sort of do these strange sentences and call out, Java Java and things like this. So it's an unusual track.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm talking with Mark James about his new documentary, Studio 17, The Lost Reggae Tapes. Your film features another musician, Lord Protector. Who is he?
Lord Creator, Lord
Lord Creator,
Creator.
sorry.
That's
Let me
okay.
try that
Well,
again.
Lord
Let me try that
Creator.
again. Your film
Yeah.
features musician, Lord Creator. Who is that?
Well, Lord Creator is a sort of amazing character. He was actually born in Trinidad and arrived in Jamaica. He was the real sort of popular singer of the time, a real crooner and a real ladies' man, apparently. He said all the women used to, fall at his feet, and he was obviously very charismatic, and did this wonderful song called "The Big Bamboo," which is quite a funny sort of slightly sexual sort of song. He arrived in Jamaica just around the time. Well, he was playing in Jamaica, and Vincent Chin, with Jamaican independence in 1962, wanted to record a record. He saw the opportunity that independence presented, and wanted to make a song about it. They needed an artist. He wasn't a record producer. He'd just been selling records to the point. So he went and tracked down Lord Creator and told him to write a song about independent Jamaica. So he created, who wasn't Jamaican, he was from Trinidad, sort of got all the newspapers and read up about Jamaican independence and wrote this song called Independent Jamaica, which, by all accounts, was quite a big hit and started to make quite a lot of money. And it was that money from that song which was which really helped them expand the record shop into the studio, which came, their own studio came later. They didn't sort of just start with the studio. So Creator is a really amazing character, and we had to go a long way to sort of track him down. We couldn't find out where he lived, but we eventually found him. And he also had written a song. Later, he became very famous for a song called Kingston Town that he wrote, which was then covered by UB40. But while he was still at Randy's Studio 17, he wrote a song called King and Queen, which is actually the same song as Kingston Town, but had a different title. So he actually originally wrote it there, but then later wrote Kingston Town, which wasn't with a different label, but it wasn't a hit when he wrote it. It was only years later when UB40 covered it. It became a huge sort of worldwide hit. And at that point, Creator was sort of down on his luck and sort of actually homeless, apparently sleeping on a sort of park bench or something. And then he got the news that Kingston Town had been a huge hit, and they approached him with all the royalties, and suddenly he was able to buy a house, and he had a big hospital bills because he hadn't been well, and he paid off that and built this great big house. And the house, we visited the house in the film, and you know, it's an amazing story, actually. I mean, Creator's really at the heart of this film.
Yes, it's a great story and fantastic music. Thanks so much for talking with me, Mark.
It's a pleasure. Well, I really hope you enjoy the film and get to see it on Monday in the cinema. You know, it'd be great if your audience can get down there to the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Cinema, 7 o'clock on Monday.
Yeah. So Mark James' new documentary, Studio 17, The Lost Reggae Tapes, is having a special screening in Toronto on August 15th at the Hot Doc Cinema at 7 p.m., followed by a Q&A. This is Daniel Garber, the Movies, each Saturday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.